For the past few weeks, some of our listeners have been diligently taking photos of buildings throughout the city that they've always wondered about and then sending them in to us. Today, Christopher Gray has stopped by to reveal the forgotten histories of some of those places after a lot of research. Christopher Gray writes the Streetscapes column for the Sunday Real Estate section of the New York Times, and his book, New York Streetscapes, is out in paperback from Harry and Abrams, and I'm very pleased he could join us again today. Hello.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
So how many submissions did you get?
I would say there were nearly 20, plus another several after the cutoff date.
We actually got 80. I guess some of them didn't make it over to us. But even with 20, it must have been rather difficult to pick which buildings to research.
Well, I have to be able to answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure there's a good photograph out there that you can display on the web. And it needs to have an interesting story, too, whether the answer is accurate or not.
Were some of them immediately apparent to you?
Well, the old Schraffs at 5th Avenue and 13th Street, originally the Lone Star Cafe with the iguana, that hopped out at me.
Mm-hmm.
And other times, I got a submission of some building in Queens, Long Island City, which is all multicolored painted. I couldn't get a line on that at all.
Well, what process do you go through in researching the past lives of a building like that?
I always want there to be a good historic photograph to really show what the street was like, what the environment of the building was. No cars, lots of cars, shrubbery, vacant land, whatever. It has to be something fun to look at, really fun. And that doesn't necessarily mean a sort of high-style architecture, but vernacular architecture is just fine. And then it needs to have a good story, preferably a human story behind it.
Where do you find those photographs?
There are about 5 major suspects and then another 50 or 60 after that. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'll have a photograph lined up for a story and then wait for 5 or 6 years. Sometimes I'll have a story lined up and wait for 5 or 6 years for the photograph to run across it.
And we're calling this segment The Past Lives of Buildings because buildings often have lots of lives, don't they? They start off doing one thing and then they become something else and then something again. And that just adds to the mystery mm-hmm. of them.
They start off brand new, somebody's hopes and dreams and big investment, and then after time, like the rest of us, they go through their middle age and things start falling apart. And then, unlike us, somebody comes back often and restores them and brings them back to what is perceived to be a new condition.
We got submissions from, it's surprising, all over the world. And we're going to go to the first submitter that we're going to talk to, Peter. We're speaking to him from somewhere in Switzerland. Peter, where in Switzerland?
I'm in Bern at the moment, but I live in Zurich.
So how did you wind up becoming curious about something in Fort Greene, the Brooklyn Masonic Temple?
Well, I'm actually a New Yorker in exile, so I've walked past it many times.
That's neat.
How did you hear about the project?
Well, I'm an avid listener, so I saw it on the website.
This is a way of connecting to home?
Exactly.
When did you first become interested in this building, Peter?
Well, I'd walked past it a number of times, and it's just a very beautiful building and quite mysterious, at least because of the masonry connection. So.
Now, he said masonry, and it's a Masonic temple. I know those words don't connect to each other, but Christopher, most Masonic temples have wonderful masonry, don't they?
Mm.
Or tile work?
Yes, I've seen that. I'm not enough of a student of well, Masonic temple.
For example, City Center is one of the most gorgeous buildings in New York, and there it's got all this amazing mosaic.
And terracotta. That is astonishing. I wouldn't say the Masons, the Elks, et cetera, play such a big role in our lives as they did maybe 100 years ago. But looked at as a corpus, they're a tremendous architectural patron. They've got all these great buildings around the city, most of which are no longer controlled by them. Especially I'm thinking of the old Board of Education headquarters in Brooklyn, 110 Livingston Street, which is the size of the Battlestar Galactic and was built by the Elks in 1926.
Well, what about this building? What do we know about it now?
You know, you said it was mysterious, didn't you? And Indeed, I always thought that way too, but actually they're much friendlier than Skull and Bones, for instance. I walked up on the door, knocked on one of those big doors, a guy opens it, hey, sure, come in, look around, no problem, you know, no secrecy at all. I looked around. Inside is a high, maybe four-story high space with a balcony, which is the main 1,000-seat auditorium for when all the Masons get together. This was built in 1909 as a communal facility for all the Masonic lodges in Brooklyn. And then there are also individual lodge rooms on upper floors, which I didn't happen to go into. It looks like, on the inside, I don't know what you'd think a turn-of-the-century opera hall, opera house would look like. Not grand opera, but a more regional opera.
Peter, have you ever gone inside?
No, I assumed that there was a special door knock or something.
So. Maybe I had it.
Well, now you know you can do that.
I guess you can stay in the air. Okay, well, that's great. Thank you very much.
But so we have this Masonic temple. Has it been a Masonic temple ever since?
It still is, built in 1909, designed by Lord and Hewlett, and Pell and Corbett. And I think it's Corbett, Harvey Wiley Corbett, who was operative on the exterior. There are some fascinating details on this building that you have to look at closely to understand. He grouped the bricks to get a more colossal effect. He grouped the bricks in groups of four, and then within those four, he made the mortar joints black or very dark gray or brown, and then surrounded those with white mortar, so you think the brick is four times as large as it is. There's another wonderful detail, the columns. The typical architect is just in heaven when he can get a single-piece column all the way top to bottom. These, they couldn't do that, of course. There must be, 60 feet high, 50 feet high. So normally there are two or three joints, you know, and it's kind of annoying to see that joint. Here, Corbett, I suspect, went counterintuitively, and he made lots of little slabs, so the individual joints become part of the design, and you don't see them at all.
Is that what intrigued you about the building, or just that it didn't look like the other things that you were seeing in Fort Greene?
It's not exactly a typical Fort Greene building, no.
I agree with you. It makes me think of, is it the end or the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey? There's a giant plinth laid on the moon. Here is this little neighborhood of brownstone shoeboxes, and here is this giant cube, a nearly perfect cube set down and set back. It really looks like a foreign invader, although quite wonderful.
What streets is it located on, Peter?
Oh, that's a good question.
Claremont and Lafayette, I think.
Ah. So it's easy to get to, Claremont and Lafayette. That's not all that far from BAM.
Not at all. 5 minutes walk.
We thank you so much for talking with us. I'm sure there's some wonderful buildings in Bern as well.
Yes, rather a different architecture, though.
We're talking with Christopher Gray and listeners as part of our special The Past Lives of Buildings show, in which people have sent in photographs of buildings that they were curious about. And then Christopher went and located earlier versions. By the way, you can see the photos we're discussing on our Flickr page, along with the photos that Christopher found of them in earlier incarnations. In this case, pretty much the same incarnation.
Very few changes. I can't detect any.
And this is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's go to another listener. This is Sarah.
Yep.
And you asked about a building that is at 31 Canal Street. Now, that's just off of Essex, isn't it?
Right.
Or Orchard, or one of those streets?
Ludlow.
And what intrigued you about this building?
Well, I live right next to it.
Well, that's a good reason.
Yes. it was, up until about last year, it was a working appliance store, and it closed last February, so it's just been gated since then.
Sarah, did you ever go in and buy a washer or feign interest in a big microwave or anything?
Well, I feigned interest in a heater when my heat went out.
Did you ever go all the way in the back?
Yes. Well, I befriended the one of the man who works there, or worked there, Phil. He now works at another appliance store on Canal Street. But he actually showed me in the back upstairs where one of the old light projectors was. But the appliance part of it was just the storefront.
Now, when you say light projectors, obviously this was a movie theater at one point?
Well, it's funny because I kept harassing the woman to tell me stories, and she reminded me of my Oma, you know, my grandmother, and I'm very sentimental, and she said, oh, why do you want to know about these old things? And she would never tell me anything, and so I never got much history out of her, but I did get a space heater.
Now, this is when Sarah mentions her Oma. A part of the intriguing aspect of this neighborhood is just how multi-ethnic it has been. A Jewish section, there is a very strong Southeast Asian section. There, in fact, a lot of sari shops in the area, and many of the appliance stores were owned by Indians and Pakistanis. And there's a lot of Chinese there now. Is that part of what makes this a place like this interesting, Christopher?
Well, I did go in next door, and there were some Sikhs, and they said, "Yes, it's a theater. There's a huge auditorium in the back."
It's massive.
In back. So you've been there?
If you look at it on Google Earth, and actually, if you look at different sides of the block, you can see it takes up about 75% of the, I don't know how much, but it's huge.
I had seen only the facade that you sent in, the little narrow, 25 foot wide,
right,
highly decorated terracotta facade, sort
right.
of. French Renaissance, and I thought, well, it must have been like a Cadillac showroom or something like that. But you're right; it's the front, the little front stub of a huge theater, which backs up on Ludlow Street. I'd never looked around to Ludlow. There's what's clearly a theater kind of back door, and posted on, for instance, cinematreasures.org, which is where all the cinema buffs hang out. You'll see pictures from Warren Harris of the original interior, most of which survives. I'm not sure about the balcony, but the ground floor has been stripped of seats.
Right.
But the pictures you see on this website and possibly the NYC if they got through, it's like a giant. This was a 2,300 seat theater. I mean, on Canal and Ludlow.
What was being shown there?
It was a Nickelodeon.
Well, these were. I don't think it was. This is too big for a Nickelodeon. These were early stage performances and shows and motion pictures, typically with some sort of orchestra or live show, and also a film itself. I've never found an early performance account, but the interior, the roof is sort of the ceiling inside is sort of like a giant tent with an Eastern star, and it's I think of Persian Baroque. Always keep, but there's no such thing as Persian Baroque. But that's what.
But back to the Masons, I think.
Could be. It was designed by Thomas Lamb, the major theater architect, for Marcus Lowe, who died that same year as part of their big chain in New York. It's a time when everybody had 15 cents to go to the movies.
So it was a Lowe's theater?
It was the Canal Theater, or the Lowe's Canal. It finally went out of business in 1962, and it went.
Wait, it was showing films that late, 1962?
This is what the cinematreasures.org, actually, that's what a building permit says as well.
Well, that makes sense because I think I think soon after it closed, the appliance store moved in.
I apparently, when you hang around there, when the store is in operation, they bring the old refrigerators out on Thursdays, and then you can go in or talk your way in through the front door, as you did. I'm very envious. I was not able to get in recently. It's a spectacular little surprise that it's typical of New York where you think you know what this building is, and then you have to look around at another side of the block or some other element to really understand it.
Well, we can only hope that somebody, some enterprising person, decides that there is a need for a movie theater there and revives this theater. Would that be possible? I mean, there's a C-town in Park Slope that has a... still has the balcony of a fondly remembered theater, and there are some people who would prefer to have the movie. Just move the C-Town a couple of stores down.
Well, the question is, what about a 2,300-seat theater?
That's very big.
That is the rub. That's pretty big. That's pretty big.
Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And again, a reminder that you can see the picture that Sarah sent in, plus the pictures that Christopher found on... the Flickr page. By the way, Christopher, a listener sends this in. She writes, Christopher Gray mentioned a multicolored painted building in Queens that he couldn't get a read on. I think he means Five Points, POINTZ, a warehouse full of artist studios that's covered with beautiful graffiti.
Neat. That may well be it. Long Island City, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that the buildings that we have that you wound up selecting are either in Manhattan or Brooklyn. And I wonder if that's because both of them were cities until the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, that could be. The limiting factor is frequently whether each photograph is an economic decision. Did somebody in 1890 or 1927 make a decision to take a photograph and good enough to save and have it saved? And that often weeds out a lot of things.
But that would also suggest that these were interesting buildings, seen as interesting buildings from the start, and they remained interesting buildings. There are a lot of invisible, beautiful buildings in New York, don't you think?
I think any tenement street is full of all sorts of beauty. The tiled floors, the carving on the doors that haven't been replaced.
And the Brooklyn Museum has a collection of some of the details from buildings that have either been cleaned or destroyed. Those lion's heads and the gargoyles and some of the other things that were a normal part of the design of early 20th century buildings, late 19th century buildings.
The sculpture garden that Barbara Milstein started.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back with some more listener submissions. Stay with us here on WNYC and WNYC.org. My guest is Christopher Gray, who is the streetscapes columnist for the New York Times and also the author of New York Streetscapes, Tales of Manhattan's Significant Buildings and Landmarks, now available in paperback from Harry and Abrams. We're back with Christopher Gray, who writes the Streetscapes column for the New York Times and is the author of New York Streetscapes, Tales of Manhattan's Significant Buildings and Landmarks, published by Harry N. Abrams, I should say. And we are talking to people who have submitted buildings to get more information about them, buildings that intrigue them in different parts of the city. And I think we go now to Christian. Christian, where is the building that you found?
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Christopher. The building I'm looking at is on Park Row on the northeast corner of Beekman. It's the deep red brick building with a very sculptural presence.
That is so spectacular. The Potter Building, do you know that?
Is it the Potter Building? I probably
the Potter Building. Yes, the Potter Building.
And does it say Potter Building on the outside?
Well, I'm looking at the Flickr group, and I see the fireproof skyscraper, which I didn't realize.
Indeed, Orlando Potter, according to the New York Times, owed every 10-cent piece he made to his prophetic shrewdness, and he was worth $20 million. So that was quite a lot of prophetic shrewdness. He owned a prior building on the site, a little old, used five-story building, which he owned for investment purposes, rented out offices. His prophecy failed him on a day in 1882 when tenants in the building and also next door, including Alfred Beach, the inventor of the first New York subway, complained that there was smoke. They kept smelling smoke, and, you know, smoke, there's fire, right? Orlando Potter said, nope, there's no fire, everything's safe, it's fine. This went on for a day, and finally, the Potter Building, the old Potter Building, caught fire and burned down with a loss of five lives and a lot of property. So Orlando Potter, perhaps to redeem himself, because he didn't come off looking very good in the press after that, built the totally, totally fireproof Potter Building, and it's a massive monument to fireproof materials, specifically brick and mortar. I love that he worked with Norris G. Starkweather, the architect. Fireproofing was of tremendous importance to the city in the late 19th century, and people still had not figured out what was going on with how to really fireproof a building. It's not really until we started sprinkler buildings that it became straightened out close to what it is now.
So this is not one of the oldest buildings downtown, but downtown is an area where we do find, obviously, most of the oldest buildings in New York, the ones that have survived. So would you consider it a treasure trove, or are most of them rather undistinguished?
Well, the oldest buildings downtown have often been altered so far out of recognition it's hard to see them, unless you go to someplace like South Street Seaport. The Potter Building is interesting because it's a little nest of tall, of early skyscrapers, 1880s and early 1890s, the American Tract Society, the New York Times building, the Nassau Beekman, and the Potter building itself, which I think Andrew Dolkart has said is the oldest or one of the last of the bearing wall buildings, meaning without a steel frame supporting the outside.
Now, Christian, what intrigued you about the Potter building over all of those others?
Just, it stands out when I'm down near your building, Municipal Building, City Hall. It stands out. It pops out so much because of its deep red color. And then I really like that it has a sculptural presence to it. And now that I'm looking at the historical photo, I see so much more that in most cases I don't see from the street because I haven't ever been other buildings looking onto it, so I've missed a lot of seeing the beautiful crown of this building.
Now,
it's nice to see Christopher, the historical setting.
If this building were in Chicago, where the streets are wider and they often put alleys alongside the older buildings, we would probably have a better sense of it, wouldn't we? Isn't that a problem in New York?
I don't know about that, but Chicago certainly lionizes its skyscraper buildings at the expense of pretty much everything else except Frank Lloyd Wright.
Thank you so much, Christian. We go now to Linus. Linus, you were curious about a building that's just north of Union Square?
Yes, it is. It's on 20th Street and Broadway.
And how much did you know about this? It's the Warren Building? Is the name on the building?
The Warren Building. I didn't see the name on the building. It might be there. I should go back and check. I didn't know very much about it. I love photographing along that stretch of Broadway. It's just got a couple of exquisite buildings on it. And I got intrigued by this one ultimately because I couldn't find out almost anything about it at all apart from the designer.
So you couldn't find out stuff. Now,
right,
Christopher, of course, you could find out things.
Yes, but anybody can. But you have to spend time on it. And you know the designer as?
Stanford White.
Yeah, of course. Isn't that neat? And this is a typical Stanford White building.
Really? Stanford White building?
Very much like
20th Street.
Very much like the Century Club, if you look at that highly articulated brick and terracotta,
mm-hmm.
kind of like a wedding cake with frosting on it.
Just exquisite ornaments all over it.
1891. It was built by George H. Warren, who was a Newport social figure and an investor and a cousin of Whitney Warren, the architect. The peculiar thing about this is a wonderful little stretch, isn't it? That active diagonal there between mm-hmm. Union Square and Madison Square, so rich, as you say. By 1891, when this went up, all the kind of retail solid gold of this stretch was failing, and these buildings were really built for loft-type showroom-type operations, but you'd never know it from looking at this very ornate structure.
Well, is this the Ladies' Mile?
This is Ladies' Mile, as it's generally described, that is up Broadway and across 23rd Street. I've been inside, and they've taken off the balconies, which you see in these in some of the photographs here, and so you come up to the window, and the window drops right at your feet. So you stand there, and you think, well, gee, will I commit suicide today or not?
Now, why would they have taken the balconies off of a Stanford White building?
Oh, gosh, I'd like to take my pot belly off, too, right? Because they got old and troublesome, and they were difficult to repair. And that's a perfectly good reason as far as many people are concerned.
They couldn't do that now because of landmarking.
It is now in a landmark district, and yes, they couldn't do it now. And who knows, we may live long enough to see them put back their wonderful, lacy little things I see in this photograph here.
That would be delightful.
But then, I'm not sure if posted on the web is the 1910 photograph of it. It really shows you that it's not the Century Club. It's rather a factory, really. It's covered with placards. Shirtwaist suits, Cremins and Roche, Erskine, millinery, linoleum, carpets, rugs, real estate, cleanser, dyers. It's really just a warehouse-type operation. And that's what it was built as. And it's so peculiar that so much detail was put into it.
Linus, thank you so much for participating.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Thank you, Linus.
You know, we've gotten a number of calls about 31 Canal Street. People remember it with great fondness as a place that they used to meet, and you used to see some of the latest Hollywood productions there. So this was, for Lower East Siders, this was a major movie house.
The historian Warren Harris says his analysis is that Marcus Lowe made a mistake building this big house, 2,300 seats, so far east on Canal. And perhaps one proof of that is that Eddie Cantor opened one of his films in his old neighborhood at 31 Canal, but then the next day they moved it up to the Capitol in Times Square. And he says it always lost money, or almost always lost money. But a wonderful building. I hope to get inside sometime.
Well, we're joined now by Sam, who asked about another movie palace. Sam, where is it?
Hi, Leonard. Hi, Christopher.
Hi.
The movie palace is the King's Flatbush Palace.
Oh, but that's one of the great buildings of Flatbush Avenue. This has been considered a treasure for a long time, hasn't it, Christopher?
Well, treasure is worth only what somebody will pay for it, and this is a sad, sad story, I would say, in from the point of view of the theater itself. And Sam, you must know this yourself. You've seen this theater empty, really, for 30 years, and not derelict. The roof has been repaired, but the city has owned it for three decades, and Marty Markowitz, the Brooklyn Borough President, says this is going to come back or else, and it may be or else, because I don't see a user coming into this location with 3,600 seats. That seems a little unlikely.
Well, they could, of course, break it up into a multiplex, as they've done with others. But there was a string of wonderful movie palaces on Flatbush Avenue at one point, and they're all closed now, aren't
And it
they?
Shows how local communities could support these big houses with a very small capture area, but now you just don't see that. I mean, heck, where is there a 3,600-seat theater anywhere?
Is this as grand as some of the big ones in Manhattan were?
Yeah, with the exception of Radio City Music Hall. This was one of Lowe's five wonder theaters, which were built in four of the boroughs and also in Jersey City. Pretty much all the same usual formula, over 3,000 seats, and even more spectacular, I think, than the auditorium is always that, maybe you remember it from going inside, Sam, the foyer, which is big enough to hold like a Navy blimp, I always think, and it's got as much decoration on it in a relatively smaller space than I think the whole auditorium itself.
Now, there were a number of glorious Lowe's theaters. You say five in the city. Was the one that Reverend Ike preached in on West 177th Street one of them?
That's one of the five wonder theaters. Also, the Valencia in Queen in Jamaica, which is another religious operation. The Lowe's itself, and also the Jersey in Jersey City, which a very dedicated local preservation group has brought back from the brink.
So that's the one that looks the most like it did originally?
Well, I think they're all pretty intact. And also the Paradise in the Bronx, which has also come back as a performing arts showcase. I think Lowe's Kings, although water damaged, is... The problems are not the repair of the quality of the building, although there are some problems. The problems are, how do you get somebody in that space to use that? I mean, even on 72nd and 3rd, it would be hard to figure out a good use for that.
Now, Sam, do you live in the area?
I live in Park Slope, actually.
Which is a little far away. I guess the question would be, could a movie theater survive in that area? And I guess no investor is willing to take the chance.
You know, there's a problem. That's a very active strip of Flatbush, but it's kind of hard to get to from a vehicular point of view, and the subway service is not that good. It's kind of good enough, but not really good enough. And like Brooklyn is over-churched, it might be that Brooklyn is over-theatered, or at least Flatbush Avenue is over-theatered.
We keep on getting information from listeners, and a listener says that Barbara Streisand was an usher at 31 Canal. Well, Barbara Streisand went to high school just down the block from the Lowe's King on Flatbush Avenue. She went to Erasmus.
And she attended Lowe's Kings, and it's widely said that she was an usher at Lowe's Kings, but that fact, quote fact, does not pop up in any of her biographies.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Oh, no, thank you.
And now we go to Gus. Hi, Gus.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Where's the building that you were curious about?
It was the Corn Exchange Bank on the corner of 125th and I believe it's Park Avenue. It's visible from the Metro North station there.
It has a kind of a spire or a water tower that is visible from the station?
That was another building. I sort of cheated. I didn't send in a picture. I just sent in a letter. There are two structures that I see all the time. I've been commuting for the last 20 years. This particular building is just very striking. I've watched it deteriorate over the last 20 years to the point where the surrounding neighborhood, ironically, has gotten better and the building has gotten worse.
It is a municipal tragedy played out in living color every day for Metro North commuters. And I watched it for 40 years, and it's so sad. I remember when it was occupied or nearly fully occupied. And, of course, now the roof is out or much of the roof is out. It's empty inside. If it comes back, it's a designated landmark now, but that just shows you that doesn't doesn't do all that much for a building. If it comes back, I think it'll be like the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where it's got the right skin and stuff, but you can tell there's something in the eyes. It's not really an old building. It was built in 1884 as the Mount Morris Bank. When Harlem was a village, there was really not much rapid transit there yet. It was still a village, and this was the big Harlem Bank. They had one branch with apartments upstairs. It's a wonderful Queen Anne building if you can't dial up on the web, and you've got to go see it, with these terrific bays, oriel bays going up this side. It originally has 7 or 8 chimneys with flared tops and a stepped gables on each side. Terrific details that you see. I think you can see that there's a shield with a helmet in the middle of it.
Yes.
And then there's also, is there still that strapwork stairway on the side made out of iron straps and bars?
Not visible from the train, mm-hmm. No.
A terrific 1880s building, especially in a city that doesn't have many big Queen Anne-style buildings like this.
Well, it seems atypical for a bank building because most of the bank buildings that were put up at that time were kind of like Roman temples, weren't they?
Well, I think this is from an earlier period, Leonard, in the 1880s when banks had a different persona. And
more neighborhood, more
neighborhood. And I can't think of what the typical bank of the 1880s was as a branch operation. They may have simply had small offices in existing buildings. But here they made a big architectural statement. This is one of the big buildings in Harlem. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you are pointing out to the tower in the distance. Is it perhaps the watchtower in Mount Morris Park?
That is probably it.
It's a fire watchtower. I mean, it's just so fascinating to me that you can think of the city in 1856, where they'd have a guy 24/7 standing on top of the watchtower looking over the whole city trying to spot a fire. It just sounds so possibly crude, but it worked.
Well, it's what forest rangers do now in parts of the Southwest.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
So maybe there was a lot of forest here as well.
Well, it's more that we didn't have the technological ability to communicate well. And he rang a bell, and, you know, 4 bells was northeast and 5 bells was northwest. I love this building, and it's just been so sad to see it go to hell, if that's a permitted word here.
I know. The ironwork just struck me as being gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was very striking 20 years ago, and especially with the surrounding area. It was just a joy to watch it.
And it is particularly ironic, if it only it had been kept warehoused properly, because the city has owned it for 30 or 40 years, warehouse properly now with the revival of 125th Street. There's some huge hotel going up across the street. Anybody would snap that up. But this is a number of false starts, just as with the Lowe's Kings.
Gus, thank you.
Reading in the Sun. There was an article. I pulled it up on online. And supposedly it's going to be renovated this year, and it's going to include a culinary institute as well as retail shops downstairs.
That's great. The Culinary Institute project has been around for 4 or 5 years, so...
Yeah.
I don't want to cast doubt on those troubled waters, but I hope that's the case.
Thank you so much. You know, talking about these different buildings reminds me that the buildings really tell us a lot about the history of New York and about the people who we treasure in New York. As listeners point out, the RKO Albee in downtown Brooklyn was Edward Albee's adoptive parents' theater. There are all sorts of other things. You know, they tell us about how immigrants came and adjusted and what neighborhoods were doing what at any given time. I think New York probably doesn't treasure these things in the way that other cities do. You go to Italy and all the old buildings are given some kind of special treatment. Often lights are on them. And again, Chicago does that. Some other cities do it. But in New York, we just take it for granted and let some of these great ones deteriorate, and that's the way it is.
We've got a big inventory. It also shows, though, that you really need an economic use for these buildings, just a kind of landmark label, or that doesn't do it. You really need somebody in a building and operating it and paying the taxes or keeping the roof up.
Now, we got an email from someone who used to work at the National Archives in Manhattan, an avid streetscapes reader. He says that he wonders whether putting all of their records on microfilm and online now has made your life a little easier.
Oh, tremendously easier. I think of my friends I know, colleagues who died 5 or 10 years ago, they would be in heaven today, now earthly heaven. It's just so terrific. You really can research, get a pretty good profile on a building in your pajamas at your computer terminal.
If you would like to see the photos that we've been discussing. They're on our website at WNYC.org on the Past Lives of Buildings page with links to Flickr. And my great thanks to all of you who sent in pictures, and especially, of course, to Christopher Gray, the author of the Streetscapes column in the New York Times, and also of this wonderful book, New York Streetscapes, Tales of Manhattan's Significant Buildings and Landmarks, available from Harry N. Abrams. And I particularly enjoy this because now I'm tempted. I want to go and see that Stanford White building, that's for sure. But all of these buildings sound like they must be just wonderful.
Each building is like a person. They're all different.
Thank you so much for being with us. On tomorrow's show, Liev Schreiber and Eric Boghossian discuss the Broadway revival of talk radio, and then the curator of the Martin Ramirez exhibit at the American Folk Art Museum, a look at some Ethiopian religious icons and other objects of worship on display at the Museum of Biblical Art, plus what's in processed foods like Twinkies on Please Explain. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Gabriel Galanik, Samantha Morgenstern, Tamara Shapiro, and Tess Hartman. Tim MacArthur was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host, and I'll see you tomorrow.